Michael Nicholson, reel 22.
So off we went into the bush and into the unknown with about 10 other guys who'd survived the ambush, including Ben. He later told me that he'd never ever known anything like it. He'd been in that sector fighting the war for about 3 years with UNITA, and none of that time had he or any other UNITA convoy been ambushed. He said never had the MPLA or the Cubans ever been that far south, and he couldn't understand why they'd come then. So my first reaction, of course, was to ask whether it could be us. Almost certainly the MPLA knew that we were there, because they had people in Kinshasa too. And it seemed to me that the very last person or the very last people President NATO, the MPLA, wanted were Western journalists, advertising, publicising UNITA. So I wondered whether in fact that ambush had been for us, to kill us. And I asked Ben this, and he simply smiled. I never knew quite whether that was a yes or just a simple gesture of sympathy, knowing what was ahead of us. Well, we walked for about 3 or 4 days and nights. And remember, we weren't prepared for this. We'd lost a lot of stuff on the lorry. Still had our camera, thank God, and bits and pieces. We were not prepared for a hike in soft sand. That was the killer. The soft sand, you just couldn't get a grip on it. Both my big toes are now crippled with arthritis, osteoarthritis, I think it's called. And the doctors say it must be because of the way they were digging into sand to try and give you power. And Mickey also suffered terribly from his feet afterwards. That and the flies were our biggest problem, but I'll tell you more about flies later. We had to be careful, of course, too, and not just that the Cubans, having discovered they hadn't killed us, were pursuing us, but there was another guerrilla group working in that area, SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organization. And these were people who were fighting for their own independence from the South Africans, who we later discovered were, linked to the Cubans. They had swapped intelligence. So we had to avoid them. So, Ben and his 10 guerrillas were protecting us not just from the Cubans, but from SWAPO too. So eventually, after 3 or 4 nights, we arrived in the camp, absolutely filthy, exhausted. We were very unfit, you imagine, at that time. And we were given a hut. We were given water to wash and shave and food. And we thought, thank God, any minute now or any moment now, perhaps tomorrow we'll meet Savimbi, it'll all be over. But the next morning, they broke the news to us that because of the ambush, Savimbi had called off the interview and had fled north. And we weren't expected to meet him. And I said, what do you mean, for another few days? They said, oh, not for another few weeks. So I said, no, thank you, I want to go home. I want to get out. And they said, no, I'm sorry, but that can't be arranged. You're with us now until Dr. Savimbi says you can go. Now, unknown to us, by bad coincidence, that may have been the reason why Savimbi had invited us in there to begin with, the Cuban MPLA began their major offensive that August. So we suddenly found ourselves not just in a hostile country, but a country that was now embarking on the most active war of all within that region. And every day there were aircraft coming over, there were helicopters coming over, and the only thing that protected us was the bush. We couldn't have survived in the open. And once that offensive began, we started our travels again. We were accompanied by now by about 20 or so guerrillas. We'd changed, but Ben was still with us. Some were only 12 years old, but carrying their own equipment and thankfully carrying some of our own bits and pieces. I'd packed a sleeping bag, which I still had with me, and I still had my washing kit, and I had a change of shorts. a tattered ground sheet. But you know, little by little, we were losing heart. We were going in the wrong direction. We were going north when, you know, we knew home was in the south. And it's a dreadful thing to know the position of the sun. You wake up in the morning and the sun's in the east, sun's on your right. And at night, the sun's gone down in the west on your right, and you know you're still facing north. Because that's the only indication you have of which direction you're going is the sun. And also the watch. I've never worn a watch since, but you know, walking, you start your walk at about 5 in the morning as soon as it gets light, and you walk until 11 until it's too hot to walk, and then you have to sit and sleep and shelter in the shade and eat until about 4 in the afternoon when the sun's lost its heat, and then you start your walk again until about 11. And then you rest until 4 the next one. That's how it was, day after day after day. Excuse me. And in the walk, you walk single file, Indian file, and all you watch is the man's heels in front. You don't look up. You just watch the man's heels in front. And every now and again, of course, you think, oh, thank God, it must be near break time now. And you look at your watch, and you've only been walking an hour. And it was so depressing. Eventually, I took my watch off, and I never wore a watch afterwards. The other great problem, of course, was water. We only had one water bottle each. We couldn't carry more. And until we became disciplined, you know, you drink water when you become thirsty. Say within an hour or so, your water's gone. And I can't describe to you, it's impossible to describe to you, the mounting hysteria that builds up within you as your thirst grows, and also your knowledge that you have no water in your can, and you don't know where the next water hole is. I won't dwell on it, but it's how I imagine it must be to be a heroin addict and not have a fix. Because water is the greatest fix of all, as I discovered. I remember on one occasion when we hadn't seen water for 2 days. So I was walking an entire day without water. And Tom too. But Mickey had some in his bottle. We could hear it kind of slurping. And it was particularly bad that night because we camped down in a petrified forest that had burnt. So well, it was just a forest of charcoal. We actually slept in charcoal, so you know, we were breathing in charcoal. We were covered in filth. And you can imagine how dry it was. And we had no water, and yet Mickey still had this tiny drop in the bottom of his bottle. And we hated Mickey. Tom and I later said that we could have killed him for that water. I mean, we hated the man. I can't tell you how much we despised and hated him for the water he had. Like, you know, it's like the movies when you see a man attacking another man with a knife to grab the water bottle. You've seen it in westerns, haven't you? That's how we felt. But Mickey later told us, because the next day we came to a waterhole, and Mickey told us that it was only that little knowledge of the little water in the bottle, which would not have quenched his thirst, but knowing that he still had a little bit of water that kept him going. And from then on, of course, we adopted the same idea. Just keep it a little bit so you can hear it, so you know it's there. And that helps you get over those ghastly, ghastly hours. Survival, of course, became how to survive it. Not mentally, of course, we were slowly beginning to cope with it. Once the realization was that we were, hostage, I suppose you'd call it, captive, I call it. Hostage means that you're being held in return for something, isn't it? You know, hostage in an aircraft, hostage in an embassy. You give us this and we return the hostages. We were really captive. We couldn't go anywhere without the Unita guerrillas. We had no way of knowing how to get out. We didn't know how close the border was. I mean, how close the sea was, how close the border east, which was Zambia, was, or north, Kinshasa, Zaire, southwest Africa, Caprivi Strip. We had no idea where we were. We'd taken a map with us, but as soon as they knew we had a map, they took it from us. So the only way was, you know, they said the sun was east in the morning, it was west at night, that meant we were facing north. And how we prayed that one morning we would wake up and the sun's position would be reversed, that meant that we were actually going south and home. We had to wait many, many months before that happened. But we learnt how to survive. We learnt how to scoop holes in the sand to make our sleeping bag more comfortable. We learned how to keep our sleeping bag inside out during the day so that when it was turned back again for night, there was nothing nasty inside it. But having said that, Mickey climbed into his sleeping one night and, thank God, touched something soft and got up fast. He touched it with his foot and it was a cobra. We learned how to stuff our boots with straw so that, or grass, so that nothing could creep in during the night, because you could shake your boots, but if a scorpion was in there or a spider, you wouldn't shake it out. And there were lots of scorpions there and lots of snakes. We learned to eat in the shade. We were eating mealie and corned beef as long as it lasted. And you eat in the shade. The flies tend to keep away from the shade. But there were times when there was very little shade, so you had to eat your food covered in your sleeping bag. You ate in the dark, open it, and the flies would just swarm onto your face. The sky was sometimes black with flies. And when we stayed in a camp long enough, they would make us a little kind of hut of straw and leaves. We spent all day and all night in that hut, because to go out would be to be totally encased in flies. And the men who brought us our food, we wouldn't allow into the tent or into our little hut, because they would bring these, they were covered in flies, they would bring the flies into the hut, we wouldn't get rid of them. So they just slipped our food under, and you know, we kept our sleeping bags against the door, keep out the light and keep out the, and they would slip the food under the sleeping bags. And we would spend 10 hours sometimes sitting in that little hut, just the three of us, in the dark, trying to keep conversation going, trying to respect each other's privacy. Very important that when you're held captive together, even in a little room. I mean, the hut was no more than, I don't know, 6 feet by 8 feet, if that, dirt floor. You slept on the floor. No chairs, no tables, of course. Nothing to read, nothing to do. If somebody wanted a little bit of privacy, not to talk, then you'd respect it. You became very polite with each other. Very important to when you're in a situation where you're spending day after day, week after week, month after month, in that kind of captivity. To stick to basics. To keep your temper, to be polite, to be over polite, really. Like, you know, passing the food around. After you, Claude. No, after you, Cecil. Then, you know, please, you have it first. And on occasions when there wasn't little food, and they would send in a plate full of just kind of cookies, or just bits of mealie meal which they'd toasted over the fire. Sometimes with honey, if there were bees around, they'd get honey, and they'd send in a plate, you know, of eight or nine of these little cookies, and you were ravishing hungry, but you'd pass it around, you know, and it's that kind of politeness that helped to keep you together, because you can imagine what would happen if some kind of hatred had developed, some dislike had developed, some vendetta had developed, it would have been very dangerous. No, we were all terribly polite to each other. One evening, I remember we were sitting around a fire. I may have told you before, it's very easy, isn't it, over the years to embellish stories. And it's part of a journalist's trade, I suppose, to liven up a story, spice up a story, just add a few things here and there, a little adjective, maybe two, just to make a line come alive a bit. I think it's called poetic license, journalistic license. And after years, when you read what you did, or when you tell of what you did, you're quite aware, you're not quite certain where fantasy is over embellishing fact, you know. So it's very hard looking back at times to know, you know, did I imagine that? Did I embellish it? Did it really happen that way? And I remember one evening, which I find very hard to believe, and nobody does believe it, but certainly the crew, unfortunately Mickey's dead now, but Tom remembers it, where we were sitting by a campfire, and I was open by the fire, crouching, the other two were in their sleeping bags. And I had a walking stick that Tom had made for me out of a kind of hornbeam, very, very hard wood, absolutely like rock. I've still got it. And I always had it by me. And suddenly, Mickey shouted out, "Watch out, Nick, there's a scorpion." And I turned around, and this big white scorpion was coming towards me with its tail up. Yeah, about 2 yards away. And I picked up my stick, and I, a bit like spitting on that fly, I kind of whopped it down, and I hit it and smashed it open. And I kind of chortled. And then Tom said, "Nick, there's a snake." And there was a snake, it looked like a mamba. Just about the worst snake you could ever be confronted with. I mean, had it hit me, I'd have been dead within a few minutes. And I, again, kind of swung round the stick and whopped it and crushed its skull. And we just all looked at each other. You know, at night time, by a campfire, everything is magnified. I don't know if you ever noticed that, but sitting by a campfire, everything is magnified. Not just sights, but sounds and feelings, emotions, all magnified. And we just all looked at each other, as if to say, is this happening to us? Only a few weeks ago, we were sitting in the sunshine in a hotel in Maputo, eating piri piri prawns. I was about to go on holiday with my wife to Malawi with my children. And here we are, sitting by a campfire, in the middle of the bush, filthy dirty, half naked, and we've just killed a scorpion and a black mamba. It is astonishing to look back, but believe me, it happened. I find it hard to believe at times.
What sort of state was your health in at that time, you know, with all this marching and living in those conditions?
How was our... Our fitness? Well, we were becoming fitter by the day. I mean, I went into Angola. I was a pretty thin guy in those days. I was about 12 and a half stone. I'm 6 feet tall, so 12 and a half stone was a good weight. When I came out of Angola, over 4 months later, I was near a 10 stone. I'd lost 2.5 stone in 4.5 months. But I fit as a fiddle, of course, and I came out with a huge beard. But no, we were, in the end, we became very fit. The tragedy happened, and it could have been I call it a disaster, it could have been a tragedy. It could have ended in the death of Mickey. Mickey was older than the rest of us. Tom was the youngest. I was a middle-ager, and Mickey was about 10 years older than me. And not a very fit man when he went in. He was a drinking man, liked his whiskey, and was not known to be a keen on walking. So to begin with, it was very, very hard work. And we were all suffering from heat exhaustion. And we were a lot of the time carrying our own gear. And Mickey did suffer to begin with. But the worst of it was we had to came a point where we had to cross a number of rivers. Now, these are fairly shallow rivers, tributaries of the Okavango, Kunene River. Now, we were told, and they did it, those who had shoes, most of them had flip-flops on, but the gorillas, those who had boots, said, we must take your boots off, because if you get your feet wet, and put them, get your boots wet, then you'll get blisters. You'll get some foot sores. So Tom and I did that, but Mickey did not. Mickey had been told, as we all had been told, that in that part of Africa, as in many parts of Africa, there is a snail. And if that snail gets into any cut or any crevice of your body, it would infect you with bilharzia. And bilharzia is fatal. It's called the sleeping disease. So Mickey wasn't prepared to get bilharzia, so he refused to take his boots off. He was a very stubborn man. Not a man you could argue with or convince, persuade. Once he set his mind to something, that was it. And sure enough, a day or so later, Mickey's wet boots, rubbing against his skin, he got blisters. And they became quickly infected. Imagine the flies. It's such a point that he couldn't walk. So I don't know whether I did the right thing or not, but I did what I thought was the right thing to do, the only thing to do. And with Tom's knife, I cut the blister and then peeled the skin off these blisters on his ankle and his heel. And then we only had some aspirins. So I crushed the aspirins into a powder, and I had a tiny miniature bottle of whiskey, which I'd picked up on the Swiss Air flight to Kinshasa, which I was hoping to use for our celebration night, the night we got out. So I doused his foot in this whiskey, the only antiseptic we had, and then we pressed the aspirin onto the sore, red sore, dreadful. And then covered it in leaves and tied handkerchief around it. And then I had a spare pair of shoes, again, which I was keeping for our celebration night out. and I cut the heels off the shoes so they became slippers. And so Mickey could walk in them without aggravating the sores on his heels, which worked for a while, but then the sand got into the blisters and the flies got in, and Mickey collapsed. It was obvious that his feet were beginning to rot. His toenails were turning black. And, you know, thank God there was no sign of green, which would obviously be the first indication. The kind of blue-green of gangrene. But we just didn't know what to do. I mean, we came to this point where we had a choice. And we talked about it. We talked of this choice among ourselves. Mickey, you know, was sick, but he could talk. And we said, look, what do? We all stay here, and we will be captured by the MPLA, or worse, by SWAPO. We leave Mickey here with the villagers. We're in a village, near a village, and go on us on our own and hope we can get help. Perhaps find a doctor, God knows what. or what? Or just drag Mickey in this pain with us. Well, thank God the decision wasn't left to us, because Ben, who was still with us, disappeared that morning. He came back with an oxen and a canoe. Now, I told you the sand was very soft there, didn't I? I mean, it was like powder. So you couldn't use wheels. So what the people who worked there, the villagers and the natives worked there, they had dugout canoes, like as you would use in a river, and sometimes, of course, they use them in rivers, but they just towed the canoe and oxen. It was like a sledge. And so we made Mickey comfortable in this sledge and covered him up so the flies couldn't get to him. And we towed him in the sledge. But things were not getting better for Mickey. I mean, he wasn't improving, even though he was resting. And I have to say that it then dawned on us that Mickey was going to die. And then one day out of the bush, I suppose we were pretty close to kind of giving in by then, out of the bush came another UNITA troop marching in the opposite direction, going south, lucky devils. And with them was the medicine man. There he was, something out of, well, I don't know. He was, he had a halo on over his head. He had to have a halo. But in every other way, he looked less like a doctor or less like a soldier than anyone I've ever seen. He was old and thin with spectacles. He had, you know, these, what they call pince-nez, you know, the, I don't know how to pronounce that, but the little things on his dirty old things. And he had what looked like a Boy Scout's hat on. But he carried with him a bag. And in the bag we saw lint and iodine and bandages and creams. And we thought, thank God, thank God. But then he got Mickey to lie down under a tree. And I've got photographs of Mickey under that tree. And I'm telling you, he looks as if he's on death's doorstep. And he opened his bag. But he didn't bring out any of the recognizable bits of medicines. He gave Mickey a drink from a bottle. It was the color of tea. I thought it was whiskey at first. And Mickey's eyes, his pupils grew blacker and larger. And then his head sank back. And with his eyes open, he just kind of stared, unseeing. And the medicine man, I can see it still, the old bifocals, or whatever they're called, sitting on them, this little thin nose, spread out a dirty towel, which I remember was monogrammed with the name of a hotel in Luanda, and with an unsterilized knife, cut off Mickey's black toenails. Just cut them all off. Took about half an hour. And then he put some kind of lotion on Mickey's sores. And then it was done. I said it took about half an hour. He gave Mickey another potion from another bottle. And the magic was done. Mickey sat up, couldn't walk, of course, he sat up, didn't know what had happened, felt no pain, all his toenails had gone, but they didn't hurt, and with that the miracle man was gone. Before we could even thank him, he'd gone off with his troop. And that day our escorts built, knowing we couldn't move, they built a little camp around us. And by dusk, this little piece of jungle had become a camouflaged clearing of about 10 huts. And there we would have to stay until Mickey convalesced. Obviously, the medicine man had said something to Ben that no way was Mickey to travel. So that night, Mickey lay on a bed, mind you, that had been specially built for him. And he was drinking juices from berries and roots that had been especially gathered for him. And he was eating barbecued meat from a small deer, which had been tracked and I suppose shot especially for him. And I wrote at the time that no one suffered more for such a mistake or endured the consequences so bravely. And sure enough, within the week, Mickey had recovered enough to walk. He never walked properly again, But the pain did have an astonishing effect on him, because at the beginning